10-acre reservation south of Phoenix. Many of the region's colonial-era records survived in the Mexican town of Altar, in the border state of Sonora. Ezell wanted to examine those records and asked Dobbins to come along. One weekend, the two men drove from Phoenix to Nogales on the border. From Nogales, they went south, west, and up into the highlands, often on dirt roads, to Altar. Then a huddle of small houses surrounding a dozen little stores. Altar was, Dobbins said, the end of the earth. Local women still covered their heads with shawls. Gringo visitors, few in number, tended to be prospectors chasing rumors of lost gold mines in the mountains. After surprising the parish priest by their interest in his records, the two young men brought out their principal research tool, a Contura portable copier. An ancestor to the Xerox photocopier that required freshly stirred chemicals for each use. The machine strained the technological infrastructure of Altar, which had electricity for only 6 hours a day. Under flickering light, the two men pored through centuries-old ledgers, the pages beautifully preserved by the dry desert air. Dobbins was struck by the disparity between the large number of burials recorded at the parish and the far smaller number of baptisms. Almost all the deaths were from diseases brought by Europeans. The Spaniards arrived, and then Indians died, in huge numbers at incredible rates. It hit him, Dobbins told me, like a club right between the eyes. At first he did nothing about his observation. Historical demography was not supposed to be his field. 6 years later, in 1959, he surveyed more archives in Hermosilla and found the same disparity. By this point, he had almost finished his doctorate at Cornell and had been selected for Holmberg's project. The choice was almost haphazard. Dobbins had never been to Peru. Peru, Dobbins learned, was one of the world's cultural wellsprings, a place as important to the human saga as the Fertile Crescent. Yet the area's significance had been scarcely appreciated outside the Andes, partly because the Spaniards so thoroughly ravaged Inca culture, and partly because the Inca themselves, wanting to puff up their own importance, had actively concealed the glories of the cultures before them. Incredibly, the first full history of the fall of the Inca Empire did not appear until more than 300 years after the events it chronicled. William H. Prescott's History of the Conquest of Peru, published in 1847. Prescott's thunderous cadences remain a pleasure to read, despite the author's firmly stated belief, typical for his time, in the moral inferiority of the natives. But the book had no successor. More than a century later, when Dobbins went to Lima, Prescott's was still the only complete account. A fine history, John Hemming's Conquest of the Incas, appeared in 1970, but it too has had no successor, despite a wealth of new information. The Inca were largely ignored because the entire continent of South America was largely ignored. Patricia Lyon, an anthropologist at the Institute for Andean Studies in Berkeley, California, explained to me. Until the end of colonialism, she suggested, researchers tended to work in their own country's possessions. The British were in Africa, along with the Germans and French. The Dutch were in Asia, and nobody was in South America, because most of its nations were independent. The few researchers who did examine Andean societies were often sidetracked into ideological warfare. The Inca practiced a form of central planning, which led scholars into a sterile Cold War squabble about whether they were actually socialists, avant la lettre, in a communal utopia, or a dire precursor to Stalinist Russia. Given the lack of previous investigation, it may have been inevitable that when Dobbins traced births and deaths in Lima, he would be staking out new ground. He collected every book on Peruvian demography he could find, and he dipped into his own money to pay Cornell project workers to explore the Cathedral Archives and the National Archives of Peru and the Municipal Archives of Lima. Slowly tallying mortality and natality figures, Dobbins continued to be impressed by what he found. Like any scholar, he he eventually wrote an article about what he had learned. But by the time his article came out, in 1963, he had realized that his findings applied far beyond Peru. The Inca and the Wampanoag were as different as Turks and Swedes. But Dobbins discovered, in effect, that their separate battles with Spain and England followed a similar biocultural template, one that explained the otherwise perplexing fact that every Indian culture, large or small, eventually succumbed to Europe. Shouldn't there have been some exceptions? And then, reasoning backward in time from this master narrative, he proposed a new way to think about Native American societies, one that transformed not only our understanding of life before Columbus arrived, but our picture of the continents themselves. Tawantinsuyu. In 1491, the Inca ruled the greatest empire on earth. Bigger than Ming Dynasty China, bigger than Ivan the Great's expanding Russia, bigger than Songhe in the Sahel, or powerful Great Zimbabwe in the West Africa Tablelands, bigger than the cresting Ottoman Empire, bigger than the Triple Alliance, as the Aztec Empire is more precisely known, bigger by far than any European state, the Inca dominion extended over a staggering 32 degrees of latitude, as if a single power held sway from St. Petersburg to Cairo. The empire encompassed every imaginable type of terrain, from the rainforest of Upper Amazonia to the deserts of the Peruvian coast and the 20,000-foot peaks of the Andes between. If imperial potential is judged in terms of environmental adaptability, wrote the Oxford historian Felipe Fernandez Armesto, the Inca were the most impressive empire builders of their day. The Inca goal was to knit the scores of different groups in Western South America, some as rich as the Inca themselves, some poor and disorganized, all speaking different languages, into a single bureaucratic framework under the direct rule of the emperor. The unity was not merely political. The Inca wanted to meld together the area's religion, economics, and arts. Their methods were audacious, brutal, and efficient. They removed entire populations from their homelands, shuttled them around the biggest road system on the planet, a mesh of stone-paved thoroughfares totaling as much as 25,000 miles, and forced them to work with other groups, using only Runa Sumi, the Inca language, on massive, faraway state farms and construction projects. Runa Sumi, Quechua to the Spanish, is the language of all Inca names, including Inca. I use the standard Runa Sumi romanization, which means that I do not use the Spanish Inca. To monitor this cyclopean enterprise, the Inca developed a form of writing unlike any other. Sequences of knots on strings that formed a binary code reminiscent of today's computer languages. So successful were the Inca at remolding their domain, according to the late John H. Rowe, an eminent archaeologist at the University of California at Berkeley, that Andean history begins not with the wars of South American independence or with the Spanish conquest, but with the organizing genius of empire founder Pachacuti in the 15th century. Highland Peru is as extraordinary as the Inca themselves. It is the only place on earth, the Cornell anthropologist John Murrah wrote, where millions of people insist against all apparent logic on living at 10,000 or even 14,000 feet above sea level. Nowhere else have people lived for so many thousands of years in such visibly vulnerable circumstances. And nowhere else have people living at such heights, in places where most crops won't grow, earthquakes and landslides are frequent, and extremes of weather are the norm, repeatedly created, technically advanced, long-lasting civilizations. The Inca homeland, uniquely high, was also uniquely steep, with slopes of more than 65 degrees from the horizontal. The steepest street in San Francisco, famed for its nearly undrivable hills, is 31.5 degrees. And it was uniquely narrow. The distance from the Pacific shore to the mountaintops is in most places less than 75 miles, and in many less than 50. Ecologists postulate that the first large-scale human societies tended to arise where, as Jared Diamond of the University of California, Los Angeles put it, geography provided a wide range of altitudes and topographies within a short distance. One such place is the Fertile Crescent, where the mountains of western Iran and the Dead Sea, the lowest place on Earth, bracket the Tigris and Euphrates river systems. Another is Peru. In the short traverse from mountain to ocean, travelers pass through 20 of the world's 34 principal types of environment. To survive in this steep, narrow hodgepodge of ecosystems, Andean communities usually send out representatives and colonies to live up or downslope in places with resources unavailable at home. Fish and shellfish from the ocean, beans, squash, and cotton from coastal river valleys, maize, potatoes, and the Andean grain quinoa from the foothills. Llamas and alpacas for wool and meat in the heights. Each area has something to contribute. Villagers in the satellite settlements exchanged products with the center, sending beans uphill and obtaining llama jerky in return, all the while retaining their citizenship in a homeland they rarely saw. Combining the fruits of many ecosystems, Andean cultures both enjoyed a better life than they could have wrested from any single place and spread out the risk from the area's frequent natural catastrophes. Murrah invented a name for this mode of existence, vertical archipelagos. Verticality helped Andean cultures survive, but also pushed them to stay small. Because the mountains impeded north-south communication, it was much easier to coordinate the flow of goods and services east to west. As a result, the region for most of its history was a jumble of small and medium-scale cultures, isolated from all but their neighbors. Three times, though, cultures rose to dominate the Andes, uniting previously separate groups under a common banner. The first period of hegemony was that of Chavin, which from about 700 BC to the dawn of the Christian era controlled the central coast of Peru and the adjacent mountains. The next, beginning after Chavin's decline, was the time of two great powers, the technologically expert empire of Wari, which held sway over the coastline previously under Chavin, and Tiwanaku, centered on Lake Titicaca, the great alpine lake on the Peru-Bolivia border. I briefly discussed Wari and Tiwanaku earlier, and will return to them and to the rest of the immense pre-Inca tradition in chapters 6 and 7. After Wari and Tiwanaku collapsed at the end of the first millennium, the Andes split into social-political fragments and, with one major exception, remained that way for more than three centuries. Then came the Inca. The Inca Empire, the greatest state ever seen in the Andes, was also the shortest lived. It began in the 15th century and lasted barely 100 years before being smashed by Spain. As conquerors, the Inca were unlikely. Even in 1350, they were still an unimportant part of the political scene in the central Andes, and newcomers at that. In one of the oral tales recorded by the Spanish Jesuit, Bernabe Cobo, the Inca originated with a family of four brothers and four sisters who left Lake Titicaca for reasons unknown and wandered until they came upon what would become the future Inca capital, Cusco in Spanish. Cobo, who sighed over the extreme ignorance and barbarity of the Indians, dismissed such stories as ludicrous. Nonetheless, archaeological investigation has generally borne them out. The Inca seem indeed to have migrated to Cusco from somewhere else, perhaps Lake Titicaca, around 1200 AD. The colonial account of Inca history closest to indigenous sources is by Juan de Betanzos, a Spanish commoner who rose to marry an Inca princess and became the most prominent translator for the colonial government. Based on interviews with his in-laws, Betanzos estimated that when the Inca showed up in the Cusco region, more than 200 small groups were already there. Cusco itself, where they settled, was a hamlet of about 30 small, humble straw houses. Archaeological evidence suggests that the Inca gradually became more powerful. The apparent turning point in their fortunes occurred when they somehow made enemies of another group, the Chanca, who eventually attacked them. This unremarkable provincial squabble had momentous consequences. According to a widely quoted chronology by the 16th century cleric Miguel Cabello Balboa, the Chanca offensive took place in 1438. The Inca leader at that time was Viracocha Inca. The Inca sovereign had the title of Inca. He was the Inca. But he could also include Inca in his name. In addition, Inca elites changed their names as they went through their lives. Each Inca was thus known by several names, any of which might include Inca. A valiant prince. According to Cobo, Viracocha Inca had a warlike nature even as a young man, and vowed that after taking the throne, he would conquer half the world. Perhaps so, but he fled the Chanca attack with three of his four sons, including his designated successor, Inca Urcan. A younger son, Inca Cusi-Yupanqui, refused to run. Instead, he fought the Chanca with such bravery that, according to the legend, the very stones rose up to join the fray. Inca Yupanqui won the battle, capturing many Chanca leaders. Later, he skinned them in celebration. Pizarro saw the trophies on display, but first Inca Yupanqui presented the captives to his father, so that Viracocha Inca could perform the victory ritual of wiping his feet on their bodies. Fearing that Inca Yupanqui was becoming too big for his britches, Viracocha Inca chose that moment to remind his younger son of his subordinate status. The foot-wiping honor, he proclaimed, actually belonged to the next Inca, Inca Urcan. To this, Betanzos wrote, Inca Yupanqui answered that he was begging his father to tread on the prisoners, that he had not won the victory so that such women as Inca Urcan and the rest of his brothers could step on them. A heated argument led to a standoff. In a Shakespearean move, Viracocha Inca decided to settle the issue by murdering his inconvenient younger son. It was a crazy impulse, one of Viracocha Inca's generals later explained. Inca Yupanqui was tipped off and the scheme failed. The humiliated Viracocha Inca went into exile while Inca Yupanqui returned in triumph to Cusco, renamed himself Pachacuti, World Shaker, and proclaimed that the ruling Inca families were descended from the sun. Then he went about conquering everything in sight. Hey, wait a minute, the reader may be saying. This family story makes such terrific melodrama that it seems reasonable to wonder whether it actually happened. After all, every known written account of the Inca was set down after the conquest, a century or more after Pachacuti's rise. And these differ from each other, sometimes dramatically, reflecting the author's biases and ignorance, and their informants' manipulation of history to cast a flattering light on their family lines. For these reasons, some scholars dismiss the chronicles entirely. Others note that both the Inca and the Spaniards had long traditions of record-keeping. By and large, the chroniclers seem to have been conscious of their roles as witnesses and tried to live up to them. Their versions of events broadly agree with each other. As a result, most scholars judiciously use the colonial accounts, as I try to do here. After taking the reins of state, Pachacuti spent the next 25 years expanding the empire from central highland Peru to Lake Titicaca and beyond. His methods were subtler and more economical with direct force than one might expect, as exemplified by the slow takeover of the coastal valley of Chincha. In about 1450, Pachacuti dispatched an army to Chincha under Capac Yupanqui, meaning roughly, munificent honored one, a kind of adopted brother. Marching into the valley with thousands of troops, Capac Yupanqui informed the fearful local gentry that he wanted nothing from Chincha whatsoever. He said that he was the son of the sun, according to the report of two Spanish priests who investigated the valley's history in the 1550s, and that he had come for their good and for everyone's, and that he did not want their silver nor their gold, nor their daughters. Far from taking the land by force, in fact, the Inca general would give them all that he was carrying, and he practically buried the Chincha leadership under piles of valuables. In return for his generosity, the general asked only for a little appreciation, preferably in the form of a large house from which the Inca could operate, and a staff of servants to cook, clean, and make the things needed by the outpost. And when Capac Yupanqui left, he asked Chincha to keep expressing its gratitude by sending craftspeople and goods to Cusco. A decade later, Pachacuti sent out another army to the valley, this one led by his son and heir, Tupa Inca Yupanqui, Royal Honored Inca. Tupa Inca closeted himself with the local leadership and laid out many inspired ideas for the valley's betterment, all of which were gratefully endorsed. Following the Inca template, the local leaders drafted the entire populace into service, dividing households by sex and age into cohorts, each with its own leader, who reported to the leader of the next larger group. Everything was in order for the people to know who was in control, the Spanish priest wrote. Tupa Inca delegated tasks to the mobilized population, hewing roads to link Chincha to other areas controlled by the Inca, building a new palace for the Inca, and tending the field set aside for the Inca. Tupa Inca apparently left the area in charge of his brother, who continued managing its gratitude. The next visit came from Pachacuti's grandson, probably in the 1490s. With him came escalating demands for land and service. The veneer of reciprocity was fading. By that point, the Chincha had little alternative but to submit. They were surrounded by Inca satrapies. Their economy was enmeshed with the imperial machinery. They had hundreds or thousands of people doing the empire's bidding. The Chincha elite, afraid to take on the Inca army, always chose compliance over valor, and were rewarded with plum positions in the colonial government. But their domain had ceased to exist as an independent entity. In 1976, Edward N. Lutwick, now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., published a short, provocative book about Imperial Rome that distinguished between territorial and hegemonic empires. Territorial empires directly occupy territories with their armies, throw out the old rulers, and annex the land. In hegemonic empires, the internal affairs of conquered areas remain in the hands of their original rulers, who become vassals. Territorial empires are tightly controlled, but costly to maintain. Hegemonic empires are inexpensive to maintain, because the original local rulers incur the costs of administration. But the loose tie between master and vassal encourages rebellion. Every conquest-minded state is a mixture of both, but all Native American empires lean toward the hegemonic. Without horses, Indian soldiers unavoidably traveled slower than European or Asian soldiers. If brigades were tied up as occupiers, they could not be reassigned quickly. As a result, the Inca were almost forced to co-opt local rulers instead of displacing them. They did so with a vengeance. Pachacuti gave command of the military to his son, Tupa Inca, in 1463, and turned his attention to totally rebuilding Cusco in imperial style, in the process becoming one of history's great urban planners. Although he drew on Andean aesthetic traditions, Pachacuti put his own stamp on Inca art and architecture. Whereas the buildings of Sumer and Assyria were covered with brilliant mosaics and splendid pictorial murals, the Inca style was severe, abstract, stripped down to geometric forms, startlingly contemporary, in fact. According to the Peruvian critic Cesar Paternostro, such major 20th century painters as Joseph Albers, Barnett Newman, and Mark Rothko were inspired by Inca art. At the heart of the new Cusco was the Plaza of Aucaipata, 625 feet by 550 feet, carpeted almost in its entirety with white sand carried in from the Pacific and raked daily by the city's army of workers. Monumental villas and temples surrounded the space on three sides, their walls made from immense blocks of stone so precisely cut and fit that Pizarro's younger cousin Pedro, who accompanied the conqueror as a page, reported that the point of a pin could not have been inserted in one of the joints. Across their facades ran enormous plates of polished gold. When the alpine sun filled Aucaipata with its boldly delineated horizontal plain of white sand and sloping sheets of gold, the space became an amphitheater for the exaltation of light. In Pachacuti's grand design, Aucaipata was the center of the empire and the cosmos. From the great plaza radiated four highways that demarcated the four asymmetrical sectors into which he divided the empire. Tawantinsuyu, land of the four quarters. To the Inca, the quarters echoed the heavenly order. The Milky Way, a vast celestial river in Andean cosmology, crosses the Peruvian sky at an angle of about 28 degrees to the Earth's orbit. For 6 months, the stream of stars slants across the sky from, so to speak, northeast to southwest. The other 6 months, it slants from southeast to northwest. The transition roughly coincides with the transition between dry and wet seasons, the time when the Milky Way releases life-giving water to Pachamama, Mother Earth, and divides the heavens into four quarters. Aucaipata, reflecting this pattern, was the axis of the universe. Not only that, Cusco was the center of a second spiritual pattern. Radiating out from Aucaipata was a drunken spiderweb of 41 crooked, spiritually powerful lines, known as zeke, that linked holy features of the landscape, springs, tombs, caves, shrines, fields, stones. About 400 of these waka, shrines more or less, existed around Cusco. The landscape around the capital was charged with telluric power. The zeke also played a role in the Inca calendar, which apparently consisted of 41 eight-day weeks. So complexly interrelated was the network of waka and zeke, Columbia University archaeologist Terence Daltroy has written, that many otherwise diligent scholars have been reduced to scratching their heads and trusting someone else's judgment. Each waka had its own meaning, relative status, social affiliation, and set of ceremonial uses. One big stone outside town was believed to be the petrified body of one of the original Inca brothers. Inca armies often carried it with them, dressed in fine togs, as a kind of good luck talisman. To keep track of the florid abundance of shrines and lines, Cobo observed, the empire had nothing more than 1,000 men in the city of Cusco who did nothing but remember these things. Not only did Pachacuti reconfigure the capital, he laid out the institutions that characterized Tawantinsuyu itself. For centuries, villagers had spent part of their time working in teams on community projects. Alternately bullying and cajoling, Pachacuti expanded the service obligation unrecognizably. In Tawantinsuyu, he decreed all land and property belonged to the state, indeed to the Inca himself. Peasants thus had to work periodically for the empire as farmers, herders, weavers, masons, artisans, miners, or soldiers. Often crews spent months away from home. While they were on the road, the state fed, clothed, and housed them, all from goods supplied by other work crews. Conscripts built dams, terraces, and irrigation canals. They grew crops on state land and raised herds on state pastures and made pots in state factories and stocked hundreds of state warehouses. They paved the highways and supplied the runners and llamas carrying messages and goods along them. Dictatorially extending Andean verticality, the Imperium shuttled people and materiel in and out of every Andean crevice. Not the least surprising feature of this economic system was that it functioned without money. True, the lack of currency did not surprise the Spanish invaders. Much of Europe did without money until the 18th century. But the Inca did not even have markets. Economists would predict that this non-market economy, vertical socialism it has been called, should produce gross inefficiencies. These surely occurred. But the errors were of surplus, not want. The Spanish invaders were stunned to find warehouses overflowing with untouched cloth and supplies. But to the Inca, the brimming coffers signified prestige and plenty. It was all part of the plan. Most important, Tawantinsuyu managed to eradicate hunger, the Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa noted. Though no fan of the Inca, he conceded that only a very small number of empires throughout the whole world have succeeded in achieving this feat. When Tawantinsuyu swallowed a new area, the Inca forcibly imported settlers from other, faraway areas, often in large numbers, and gave them land. The newcomers were encouraged to keep their own dress and customs rather than integrate into the host population. To communicate, both groups were forced to use Rumasuni, the language of their conquerors. In the short run, this practice created political tension that the Inca manipulated to control both groups. In the long term, it would have, if successful, eroded the distinctions among cultures and forged a homogeneous new nation in the imprint of Tawantinsuyu. 5 centuries later, the wholesale reshuffling of populations became an infamous trademark of Stalin and Mao. But the scale on which the Inca moved the pieces around the ethnic checkerboard would have excited their admiration. Incredibly, foreigners came to outnumber natives in many places. It is possible that ethnic clashes would eventually have caused Tawantinsuyu to implode, Yugoslavia style. But if Pizarro had not interrupted, the Inca might have created a monolithic culture as enduring as China. The Gilded Litter of the Inca. How did Pizarro do it? Sooner or later, everyone who studies the Inca confronts this question. Henry Dobbins wondered about it too. The empire was as populous, rich, and well-organized as any in history. But no other fell before such a small force. Pizarro had only 168 men and 62 horses. Researchers have often wondered whether the Inca collapse betokens a major historical lesson. The answer is yes, but the lesson was not grasped until recently. The basic history of the empire was known well enough by the time Dobbins began reading the old colonial accounts. According to Cabello Balboa's chronology, Pachacuti died peacefully in 1471. His son, Tupa Inca, long the military commander, now took the imperial crown, a multicolored braid, twisted around the skull like a headband, from which hung a red-tasseled fringe that fell across the forehead. Carried on a golden litter, the Inca did not walk in public. Tupa Inca appeared with such majesty, according to the voyager Pedro Sarmiento de Gamboa, that people left the roads along which he had to pass and, ascending the hills on either side, worshipped and adored him by pulling out their eyebrows and eyelashes. Minions collected and stored every object he touched, food waste included, to ensure that no lesser persons could profane these objects with their touch. The ground was too dirty to receive the Inca's saliva, so he always spat into the hand of a courtier. The courtier wiped the spittle with a special cloth and stored it for safekeeping. Once a year, everything touched by the Inca, clothing, garbage, bedding, saliva, was ceremonially burned. Tupa Inca inaugurated the Inca custom of marrying his sister. In fact, Tupa Inca may have married two of his sisters. The practice was genetically unsound, but logically consistent. Only close relatives of the Inca were seen as of sufficient purity to produce his heir. As Incas grew in grandeur, more purity was required. Finally, only a sister would do. The Inca's sister wives accompanied him on military forays, along with a few hundred or thousand of his subordinate wives. The massive scale of these domestic arrangements seems not to have impeded his imperial progress. By his death in 1493, Tupa Inca had sent his armies deep into Ecuador and Chile, doubling the size of Tawantinsuyu again. In terms of area conquered during his lifetime, he was in the league of Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan. Tupa Inca's death set off a fight for the royal fringe. Tawantinsuyu did not have strict succession rules. Instead, the Inca selected the son he thought most qualified. Tupa Inca had more than 60 sons from all of his wives, according to Sarmiento de Gamboa, so he had a lot of choice. Alas, Tupa Inca apparently selected one son, but then changed his mind on his deathbed and selected another. Factions formed around each son, leading to a melee. The first son was banished, or killed, and the second took the name Huayna Capac and became the Inca. Because the new Inca was still a teenager, his name means munificent youth, two of his uncles served as regents. One uncle tried to usurp power, but was killed by the other. Eventually, the Inca grew old enough to take the reins. Among his first official acts was killing two of his own brothers to avoid future family problems. Then he, like his father, married his sister. Huayna Capac was not a military adventurer like his father. He initially seems to have viewed his role mainly as one of consolidation, rather than conquest, perhaps because Tawantinsuyu was approaching the geographic limits of governability. Communication down the long north-south spine of the empire was stretched to the limit. Much of Huayna Capac's time was devoted to organizing the empire's public works projects. Often, these were more political than practical. Because the Inca believed that idleness fomented rebellion, the Spanish traveler Pedro Cieza de Leon reported, he ordered unemployed work brigades to move a mountain from one spot to another, for no practical purpose. Cieza de Leon once came upon three different highways running between the same two towns, each built by a different Inca. Consolidation was completed in about 1520. Huayna Capac then marched to Ecuador at the head of an army, intending to expand the empire to the north. It was a journey of return. He had been born in southern Ecuador during one of his father's campaigns. He himself brought with him one of his teenage sons, Atahualpa. When Huayna Capac came to his birthplace, the city now called Cuenca, Cobo reported, he commanded that a magnificent palace be constructed for himself. Huayna Capac liked his new quarters so much that he stayed on while Atahualpa and his generals went out to subjugate a few more provinces. They did not meet with success. The peoples of the wet equatorial forests did not belong to the Andean culture system and were not interested in joining. They fought ferociously. Caught by an ambush, Atahualpa was forced to retreat. Enraged by this failure, Cobo wrote, Huayna Capac prepared himself as quickly as possible to go in person and avenge this disgrace. He left his pleasure palace and publicly berated Atahualpa at the front. In a renewed offensive, the army advanced under the Inca's personal command, bearing clubs, spears, bows, lances, slings, and copper axes. Brilliant in cloaks of feathers and silver breastplates, their faces painted in terrifying designs, the Inca army plunged into the forests of the northern coast. They sang and shouted in unison as they fought. The battle seesawed until a sudden counterattack knocked Huayna Capac out of his litter. A humiliation. Nearly captured by his foes, he was forced to walk like a plebe back to his new palace. The Inca army regrouped and returned. After prolonged struggle, it subjugated its foes. Finding the warm Ecuadorian climate more to his liking than that of chilly Cusco, Huayna Capac delayed his triumphal return for 6 years. Wearing soft, loose clothing of vampire bat wool, he swanned around his palaces with a bowl of palm wine, or chicha, a sweet, muddy beer-like drink usually made from crushed maize. When his captains and chief Indians asked him how, though drinking so much, he never got intoxicated, reported Pizarro's younger cousin and page Pedro, they say that he replied that he drank for the poor, of whom he supported many. In 1525, Huayna Capac suddenly got sick and expired in his Ecuadorian retreat. Once again, the succession was contested and bloody. Details are murky, but on his deathbed, the Inca seems to have passed over Atahualpa, who had not distinguished himself, and designated as his heir a son named Ninon Kiuchi. Unluckily, Ninon Kiuchi died of the same illness right before Huayna Capac. Next in line was a 19-year-old son who had stayed behind in Kosko. As was customary, high priests subjected this choice to a divination. They learned that the son would be dreadfully unlucky. The priests who reported this unhappy result to Wina Kapak found him dead. In consequence, the court nobles were left to choose the emperor. They settled on the teenager who had been the Inca's final choice. The teenager's principal qualification for the post was that his mother was Wina Kapak's sister. Nonetheless, he had no doubts about crowning himself immediately. He didn't even wait to find out if Wina Kapak had left any instructions or last wishes. The new Inca took the name Huashcar Inca, Golden Chain Inca. Atahualpa remained in Ecuador, ostensibly because he was unable to show his face after being berated by his father, but presumably also because he knew that the life expectancy of Inca brothers tended to be short. Meanwhile, Wina Kapak's mummified body was dressed in fine clothing and taken back to Cusco on a gold litter bedecked with feathers. Along the way, the dead emperor's executors, four high-ranking nobles, schemed to depose and murder Huashcar and install yet another son in his place. Something aroused Washkar's suspicions as the party neared Cusco, perhaps his discovery that Atahualpa had stayed in Ecuador with most of the Inca army, perhaps a tip-off from a loyal uncle whom the conspirators had approached. After staging a grand funeral for his father, Huashcar ordered the executors to meet him one at a time, which provided the occasion to arrest them. Torture and execution followed. The plot circumvented, Huashcar went to work eliminating any remaining objections to his accession. Because Wina Kapak had not actually married Washkar's mother, the union was properly incestuous but not properly legitimate. The new Inca demanded that his mother participate ex post facto in a wedding ceremony with his father's mummy. Even for the Andes, this was an unusual step. Huashcar further solidified his credentials as ruler by marrying his sister. According to the unsympathetic account of Cabello Balboa, Washkar's mother, who was apparently willing to marry her dead brother, objected to her son's plan to marry her daughter. The ceremony took place only after much begging and supplication. Civil war was probably unavoidable. Egged on by scheming courtiers and generals, relations between Atahualpa and Huashcar spent several years swinging through the emotional valence from concealed suspicion to overt hostility. Huashcar, in Cusco, had the machinery of the state at his disposal. In addition, his claim to the fringe was generally accepted. Atahualpa, in Ecuador, had a war-tested army and the best generals, but a weaker claim to the throne. His mother was merely his father's cousin, not his sister. The war lasted for more than 3 years, seesawed across the Andes, and was spectacularly brutal. Huashcar's forces seized the initial advantage, invading Ecuador and actually capturing Atahualpa, almost tearing off one of his ears in the process. In a sequence reminiscent of Hollywood, one of Atahualpa's wives supposedly smuggled a crowbar-like tool into his improvised battlefield prison. His intoxicated guards permitted a conjugal visit. Atahualpa dug his way out, escaped to Ecuador, reassembled his army, and drove his foes south. On a plateau near today's Peru-Ecuador border, the northern forces personally led by Atahualpa shattered Huashcar's army. A decade later, Cieza de Leon saw the battleground, and from the wreckage and unburied remains, thought the dead could have numbered 16,000. The victors captured and beheaded Washkar's main general. Atahualpa mounted a bowl atop the skull, inserted a spout between the teeth, and used it as a cup for his chicha. With the momentum of war turning against him, Huashcar left Cusco to lead his own army. Atahualpa sent his forces ahead to meet it. After a horrific battle, Cieza de Leon estimated the dead at 35,000. Huashcar was captured in an ambush in the summer of 1532. Atahualpa's generals took the Inca as a captive to Cusco and executed his wives, children, and relatives in front of him. Meanwhile, Atahualpa's triumphant cavalcade, perhaps as many as 80,000 strong, slowly promenaded to Cuzco. In October or November 1532, the victors stopped outside the small city of Cajamarca, where they learned that pale, hairy people who sat on enormous animals had landed on the coast. No matter how many times what happened next has been recounted, it has not lost its power to shock. How the curious Atahualpa decided to wait for the stranger's party to arrive. How Pizarro, for it was he, persuaded Atahualpa to visit the Spaniards in the central square of Cajamarca, which was surrounded on three sides by long, empty buildings. The town apparently had been evacuated for the war. How on November 16, 1532, the emperor-to-be came to Cajamarca in his gilded and feather-decked litter, preceded by a squadron of liveried men who swept the ground and followed by 5,000 or 6,000 troops, almost all of whom bore only ornamental, parade-type weapons. How Pizarro hid his horses and cannons just within the buildings lining the town square, where the 168 Spanish awaited the Inca with such fear, Pedro Pizarro noted, that many made water without knowing it out of sheer terror. How a Spanish priest presented Atahualpa with a travel-stained Christian breviary, which the Inca, to whom it literally meant nothing, impatiently threw aside. Providing the Spanish with a legal fig leaf for an attack, desecrating holy writ. How the Spanish, firing cannons, wearing armor, and mounted on horses, none of which the Indians had ever seen, suddenly charged into the square. How the Indians were so panicked by the smoke and fire and steel and charging animals that in trying to flee, hundreds trampled each other to death. They formed mounds and suffocated one another, one conquistador wrote. How the Spanish took advantage of the soldiers' lack of weaponry to kill almost all the rest. How the native troops, who recovered from their initial surprise, desperately clustered around Atahualpa, supporting his litter with their shoulders even after Spanish broadswords sliced off their hands. How Pizarro personally dragged down the emperor-to-be and hustled them through the heaps of bodies on the square to what would become his prison. Pizarro exulted less in victory than one might imagine. A self-made man, the illiterate, illegitimate, neglected son of an army captain, he ached with dreams of wealth and chivalric glory despite the fortune he had already acquired in the Spanish colonies. After landing in Peru, he realized that his tiny force was walking into the maw of a powerful empire. Even after his stunning triumph in Cajamarca, he remained torn between fear and ambition. For his part, Atahualpa observed the power of Inca gold and silver to cloud European minds. Because of their obsession with gold, the conquistadors are often dismissed as gold crazy. In fact, they were not so much gold crazy as status crazy. Like Hernán Cortés, who conquered Mexico. Pizarro was born into the lower fringes of the nobility, and hoped by his exploits to earn titles, offices, and pensions from the Spanish crown. To obtain these royal favors, their expeditions had to bring something back for the king. Given the difficulty and expense of transportation, precious metals, non-perishable, divisible, and compact, as historian Matthew Restall notes, were almost the only goods that they could plausibly ship to Europe. Inca gold and silver thus represented to the Spaniards the intoxicating prospect of social betterment. Precious metals were not valuable in the same way in Tahuantinsuyo because there was no currency. To the Inca ruler, the foreigner's fascination with gold apparently represented his best chance to manipulate the situation to his advantage. He offered to fill a room 22 feet by 17 feet full of gold objects, and two equivalent rooms with silver, in exchange for his freedom. Pizarro quickly agreed to the plan. Atahualpa, still in command of the empire, ordered his generals to strip Cuzco of its silver and gold. Not having lived in the city since childhood, he had little attachment to it. He also told his men to slay Huáscar, whom they still held captive, all of Huáscar's main supporters, and, while they were at it, all of Atahualpa's surviving brothers. After his humiliating captivity ended, Atahualpa seems to have believed the ground would be clear for his rule. Between December 1532 and May 1533, caravans of precious objects, jewelry, fine sculptures, architectural ornamentation, wended on llama-back to Cajamarca. As gold and silver slowly filled the rooms, all of Tawantinsuyu seemed frozen. It was as if someone had slipped into the Kremlin in 1950 and held Stalin at gunpoint, leaving the nation, accustomed to obeying a tyrant, utterly rudderless. Meanwhile, the waiting Spanish, despite their unprecedented success, grew increasingly fearful and suspicious. When Atahualpa fulfilled his half of the bargain and the ransom was complete, Pizarro melted everything into ingots and shipped them to Spain. The conquistadors did not follow through on their part of the deal. Rather than releasing Atahualpa, they garroted him. Then they marched to Cusco. Almost at a stroke, just 168 men had dealt a devastating blow to the greatest empire on earth. To be sure, their victory was nowhere near complete. Huge bloody battles still lay ahead. Even after the conquistadors seized Cusco, the empire regrouped in the hinterlands, where it fought off Spanish forces for another 40 years. Yet the scale of Pizarro's triumph at Cajamarca cannot be gainsaid. He had routed a force 50 times larger than his own, won the greatest ransom ever seen, and vanquished a cultural tradition that had lasted 5 millennia. All without suffering a single casualty. Virgin soil. I have just pulled a fast one. The Inca history above is as contemporary scholars understand it. They disagree on which social factors to emphasize and on how much weight to assign individual Spanish chronicles. But the outline seems not in serious dispute. The same is not true of my rendering of Pizarro's conquest. I presented what is more or less the account current when Dobbins arrived in Peru. But in his reading, he discovered a hole in this version of events, a factor so critical that it drastically changed Dobbins's view of Native America. Why did the Inca lose? The usual answer is that Pizarro had two advantages: steel, swords and armor, rifles and cannons, and horses. The Indians had no steel weapons and no animals to ride. Llamas are too small to carry grown men. They also lacked the wheel and the arch. With such inferior technology, Tawantinsuyu had no chance. "What could the Inca offer against this armory?" asked John Hemming, the conquest historian. "They were still fighting in the Bronze Age." The Inca kept fighting after Atahualpa's death, but even though they outnumbered the Europeans by as much as 100-1, they also lost. "No amount of heroism or discipline by an Inca army," Hemming wrote, "could match the military superiority of the Spaniards." But just as guns did not determine the outcome of conflict in New England, steel was not the decisive factor in Peru. True, anthropologists have long marveled that Andean societies did not make steel. Iron is plentiful in the mountains, yet the Inca used metal for almost nothing useful. In the late 1960s, Heather Leckman, an archaeologist at the MIT Center for Materials Research in Archaeology and Ethnology, suggested to an eminent scholar of Andean prehistory that we take a serious and careful look at Andean metallurgy. He responded, "But there wasn't any." Leckman went and looked anyway. She discovered that Inca metallurgy was, in fact, as refined as European metallurgy, but that it had such different goals that academic experts had not even recognized it. According to Leckman, Europeans sought to optimize metals' hardness, strength, toughness, and sharpness. The Inca, by contrast, valued plasticity, malleability, and toughness. Europeans used metal for tools. Andean societies primarily used it as a token of wealth, power, and community affiliation. European metalworkers tended to create metal objects by pouring molten alloys into shaped molds. Such foundries were not unknown to the Inca, but Andean societies vastly preferred to hammer metal into thin sheets, form the sheets around molds, and solder the results. The results were remarkable by any standard. One delicate bust that Lechtman analyzed was less than an inch tall, but made of 22 separate gold plates painstakingly joined. If a piece of jewelry or a building ornament was to proclaim its owner's status, as the Inca desired, it needed to shine. Luminous gold and silver were thus preferable to dull iron. Because pure gold and silver are too soft to hold their shape, Andean metalworkers mixed them with other metals, usually copper. This strengthened the metal but turned it an ugly pinkish copper color. To create a lustrous gold surface, Inca smiths heated the copper-gold alloy, which increases the rate at which the copper atoms on the surface combine with oxygen atoms in the air. It makes the metal corrode faster. Then, they pounded the hot metal with mallets, making the corrosion flake off the outside. By repeating this process many times, they removed the copper atoms from the surface of the metal, creating a veneer of almost pure gold. Ultimately, the Inca ended up with strong sheets of metal that glittered in the sun. Andean cultures did make tools, of course, but rather than making them out of steel, they preferred fiber. The choice is less odd than it may seem. Mechanical engineering depends on two main forces, compression and tension. Both are employed in European technology, but the former is more common. The arch is a classic example of compression. By contrast, tension was the Inca way. Textiles are held together by tension, William Conklin, a research associate at the Textile Museum in Washington, D.C., told me, and they exploited that tension with amazing inventiveness and precision. In the technosphere of the Andes, Lechtman explained, people solved basic engineering problems through the manipulation of fibers, not by creating and joining hard wooden or metal objects. To make boats, Andean cultures wove together reeds rather than cutting up trees into planks and nailing them together. Although smaller than big European ships, these vessels were not puddle muddlers. Europeans first encountered Tawantinsuyu in the form of an Inca ship sailing near the equator, 300 miles from its home port, under a load of fine cotton sails. It had a crew of 20 and was easily the size of a Spanish caravel. Famously, the Inca used foot-thick cables to make suspension bridges across mountain gorges. Because Europe had no bridges without supports below, they initially terrified Pizarro's men. Later, one conquistador reassured his countrymen that they could walk across these Inca inventions without endangering themselves. Andean textiles were woven with great precision. Elite garments could have a thread count of 500 per inch, and structured in elaborate layers. Soldiers wore armor made from sculpted, quilted cloth that was almost as effective at shielding the body as European armor, and much lighter. After trying it, the conquistadors ditched their steel breastplates and helmets wholesale and dressed like Inca infantry when they fought. Although Andean troops carried bows, javelins, maces, and clubs, their most fearsome weapon, the sling, was made of cloth. A sling is a woven pouch attached to two strings. The slinger puts a stone or slug in the pouch, picks up the strings by the free ends, spins them around a few times, and releases one of the strings at the proper moment. Expert users could hurl a stone, the Spanish adventurer Alonso Enriquez de Guzman wrote, with such force that it will kill a horse. I've seen a stone thus hurled from a sling break a sword in two pieces when it was held in a man's hand at a distance of 30 paces. Experimenting with a 5-foot-long Andean-style sling and an egg-sized rock from my garden, I was able, according to my rough calculation, to throw the stone at more than 100 miles per hour. My aim was terrible, though. In a frightening innovation, the Inca heated stones in campfires until they were red hot, wrapped them in pitch-soaked cotton, and hurled them at their targets. The cotton caught fire in mid-air. In a sudden onslaught, the sky would rain burning missiles. During a counterattack in May 1536, an Inca army used these missiles to burn Spanish-occupied Cusco to the ground. Unable to step outside, the conquistadors cowered in shelters beneath a relentless, weeks-long barrage of flaming stone. Rather than evacuate, the Spanish, as brave as they were greedy,